Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
It's now my great pleasure to welcome our guest for this evening, Michael J. Sandel, the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard University, where he has taught political philosophy since 1980. His books include Liberalism and the Limits of Justice, Democracy's Discontent, America in Search of a Public Philosophy, Public Philosophy, Essays on Morality in Politics, and The Case Against Perfection, Ethics in the Age of Genetic Engineering. His latest book is Justice, What is the Right Thing to Do? Sandel teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in contemporary political philosophy, including ethics and biotechnology, markets, morals, and law, and globalization and its discontents. His legendary Justice course is one of the most popular and influential at Harvard. Up to 1,000 students packed the campus theater to hear Sandel relate the big questions of political philosophy in the most vexing issues of the day. Professor Sandel shows how a sure grasp of philosophy can help us to make sense of politics, morality, and our own convictions as well. We're extremely honored to have the opportunity to join in dialogue with Michael Sandel tonight. And now we begin with a brief video about Professor Sandel and his work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here at this treasure of a public library to discuss a book that has come out this week. And so we're going to have a discussion about questions of justice, reasons of justice, rational and maybe not so rational always. The book is called Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? And it's based on a course that I've taught on and off for the past almost 30 years, you've just seen. And public television is making available part of a series based on the course beginning around now. It's on at different times in different stations around the country, so you can check and see when KCT is beginning it, but I think within the next week or so. It's part of an effort, the book and the series, like the course, an effort to try to elevate the debate we have all the time about politics and about the ideas of justice, the moral convictions to public debate, whether we're discussing bailouts or health care or affirmative action or same-sex marriage. The debates we have about those questions, people have strong opinions about. Those opinions reflect strong, often fiercely defended moral opinions. And yet our public debate doesn't really seem to deal very explicitly with those ideas of justice and of morality. So the project is to see how we can lift up the kind of public discourse we have so that it's less about shouting matches and more about reasoned deliberation about big moral questions. What I'd like to do this evening really is to start a discussion, sort of like we do in the class. Now, the book deals with some of the famous philosophers and what they've said about justice, their philosophies of justice and of morality. When I first started studying these philosophers, I found them daunting and distant and abstract. So what I've tried to do in the book is to make them inviting and accessible by showing that the big ideas dealt with by figures like Aristotle or Immanuel Kant or John Stuart Mill, these are ideas that actually bear on the arguments we have today. Let me give you an example by giving you a very short lecture on Aristotle's philosophy of justice back in the days of ancient Athens. Aristotle said justice is a matter of giving people what they deserve. That's the end of the lecture. Now, you might think, well, that's pretty uncontroversial. The hard questions begin when we start arguing about who deserves what. And Aristotle says, well, the answer to that depends on what we're distributing. He starts with an easy case. He says, suppose we're distributing flutes. Who should get the best ones? What do you suppose is the answer?
Musicians.
What? Musicians. Any musician.
No, the best.
The best musicians, the best flute players. That's right. Tell us your name.
Michael.
You either read Aristotle or taken this course before.
I went to the business school.
To the business school. You went, Michael.
Wait.
You went to the business school, and yet you don't think the best flutes should go to those who can afford to pay the most for them? What did they teach you there? I see. All right, fair enough. Now, here's a slightly harder question. Aristotle agreed, Michael, with you. He thought the best flute should go as a matter of justice to the best flute players. But the question is why? Why do you think they should?
I assume it's because that material, that flute, that product would be given its highest and best use. That's my assumption.
The flute will be best used, its highest and best use, if it's played by people who really know how to play it well.
Exactly.
Anyone else? Is that the reason other people think the best flute? Yeah, he used the mic. He did. All right.
Maybe the person who plays it best does not necessarily want it the most. And there's a difference between the ability to play and the desire for the flute, and therefore it confuses the relevant preferences involved.
Okay, well, that's a good suggestion.
Utilitarianism, and you get a different view.
Utilitarianism, all right. Some people might really want that flute badly, even though they're not such great musicians.
But maybe they would get greater preferences.
All right, maybe they would be happier. Suppose there is, all right, what's your name?
Bill.
So Bill has already a challenge to Aristotle, and we're still on the flutes.
Can you imagine that?
I can imagine it. Actually, it's a pretty good argument. So let me make sure people are... Well, let me be the judge of that. So Bill is saying a case could be made not for giving the best flute to the best flute players, but to giving it to the people who most want it, because on the utilitarian idea of justice, justice means making the most people happy. And if you thought of it from that point of view, suppose the greatest musician was willing to take the best flute or the Stradivarius violin, but didn't like practicing all that much. Yes, she's a gifted musician, but it's kind of painful to practice all that much. And here's someone who actually can't play it very well, but loves doing it. So Aristotle says, that's a bad reason, Bill.
It is.
He says it's a bad reason. Now, why does he say that? Well, for something like Michael's answer, Aristotle's answer is the best people deserve, the best musicians deserve the best flutes because that's what flutes are for, to be played well. That's the point of musical performance, to excel, not only to excel, but for everyone in the community to be able to honor and recognize the truly great musicians in this case. So what this exchange already tells us about Aristotle's theory of justice is that justice isn't about maximizing happiness like the utilitarians think. It's you have to reason about the purpose of the thing, in this case a flute, and in reasoning about the purpose, you have to ask yourself, what qualities connected to flutes are really worthy of honor and recognition? And the fact that someone really, really wants the flute, that's not worthy of honor and recognition. That's just a desire. If they don't play well, we want to honor and recognize those who are great musicians, at least in the domain of music we do. Now, why would a philosopher bother with what seems like a pretty narrow, silly, remote question about flutes? Well, he was interested really in how we think about justice. So let me apply this way of thinking to show how, even though we these days argue about issues that hadn't occurred to Aristotle, his way of thinking about justice actually does shed light on things we argue about today. Take the example of affirmative action. Is it just to count race and ethnicity, to take it into account when admitting students to college? Well, we have a disagreement about that. What's the disagreement about? One way of understanding the disagreement is to notice that some people say what a college is really for, the purpose of a college, is to promote scholarly excellence. So those with the best grades and test scores should be admitted. That's what a college is for, just like that's what a flute is for. And moreover, the point of having college admissions is, at least in part, to honor and recognize those who get the best grades. And so from that, if that's what college is for, if that's the only purpose of a college or a university, then only grades and test scores and scholarly promise should count. And then there are other people who say no. That's not all colleges and universities are for. They are also for the sake of promoting and cultivating leadership for a pluralistic society. There's a civic purpose in addition to a scholarly one, and therefore the admissions process rightly considers factors such as race, ethnicity, and the ability to contribute to leadership in a diverse society, or to contribute a range of perspectives to the discussions that go on. So there are two rival accounts of the purpose of a college and university education, and depending on which of those purposes you conclude is the best account, you may well come to a different answer as to what's a just way of admitting students. I'd like to put to you another illustration of a dispute. It's a dispute about rights that has to do not with flutes or with college admissions, but with golf. There was a golfer not long ago named Casey Martin. Have people heard of Casey Martin?
Yes.
He had a bad leg. He was born with a disease that afflicted his leg. And he was a terrific golfer, but he couldn't walk the course without great pain and even risk to his health, to his leg. So he asked the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association, to be able to use a golf cart in the tournaments. And they said, no. Nobody can use a golf cart. Those are the rules. And he sued them under the Americans with Disabilities Act, a law of Congress that said that any organization has to make a reasonable accommodation for people who are disabled, provided the accommodation doesn't change the essential nature of the activity. So he went to court and argued that he should be given a right to use a golf cart in the tournaments. Now, not only the PGA, but the famous professional golfers who testified in the trial said, no, that would be an outrage. Riding a golf cart in a tournament? That would give him an unfair advantage. And Arnold Palmer testified, and Jack Nicklaus, and Tom Kite, all these famous golfers, against him. And the case, believe it or not, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And, well, before I tell you how the Supreme Court ruled, let's see what you think here. If you were on the Supreme Court, how many would say that, how many would rule that the PGA should be required to provide him a golf cart? Raise your hand. And how many would say they should not be required to give him a golf cart? All right, this is interesting. We have a mix of opinion. Majority say yes, but a substantial minority say no. Let's hear, and we've got people with microphones. Speak into the microphone. Let's hear first from someone who would turn him down, who thinks there is no right that the court should enforce that Casey Martin be allowed to ride in a golf cart.
Hi. Well, there are activities for those who are disabled, such as the Olympics, etc., for disabled.
You say let him play in the Special Olympics.
Well, I don't play golf.
You don't play golf.
I don't play golf.
Right.
But walking is tiring and is part of the test of a golfer.
Right. Okay.
And therefore, he can't be taking the same test if he plays.
Okay, it's part of the game. All right, who disagrees? What's your name?
Mal?
Who disagrees with? Who says he should be given a right to use a golf cart? Yes, toward the back. What do you say?
Well, first of all, at the risk of sounding snotty, if somebody's really going to get tired from walking around a golf course, I'm going to question how professional an athlete that is. And second of all, not being a golfer either, just from what I've observed and what I've known from people who do golf, it seems the primary focus of that activity is the hand-eye coordination, the ability to hit the ball well and to hit, you know, both long shots and short shots.
It's about swinging the golf club, really.
Exactly. So I don't see where giving this guy a golf cart is really going to give him an excessive advantage.
Right. So the walking... Wait. What's your name?
Allison.
Allison. Wait, stay there. Allison, so you're saying really walking the course is no big deal. It's really not part of the sport.
Not in my opinion, no.
Right. And the real thing involves swinging the club, hitting the ball, having it go in the hole. All right.
That's how I'd see golf, yeah.
Yeah. What do you say?
I say that you have to have the legs and the endurance to be able to hit the golf ball as far and as accurate as you want it to go. So if you're tired from walking the course, all players are not going to be in the same condition.
Right.
So conditioning plays a major role.
Are you a golfer?
No.
What's your name, by the way?
My name is Thomas. I'm a personal trainer. So.
Oh, all right. Personal trainer. Now, as a personal trainer, when you watch golfers on television, do they look like they're in pretty good shape?
Well, for the most part, not really.
All right. That bears out Allison's point, doesn't it?
Well, see, first of all, you can look like you're not in great shape, but you can be functionally in great shape
in
all planes of motion.
Well, because you hit the ball well.
No.
No?
Because you have functional movement and you have strength in all planes of motion.
All right, fair enough. Now... Notice something about this argument that we've just been having. What's the argument about? In a way, it's an argument about what is essential. What's the essential nature of golf? And Mel says, oh, it's essential to the game walking the course and getting tired and surmounting that. And then Allison is saying, Not really. That's not what golf is about. Really, what golf, the excellence that golf is meant to test is the ability to swing that club, hand-eye coordination, hitting the ball a long way, getting it into the hole. That's what golf is essentially about. In walking, that's an incidental aspect. So the disagreement that we've had, even in this brief discussion, is a disagreement about what is essential to golf and what is merely incidental. What's the point of golf? This is an Aristotelian argument. He says that's just his point. Just like with the flute. To reason about justice and rights is to argue about what's the point of the game? What skills are the game meant to test? And there's a disagreement, as there was for the court. Now, what did the Supreme Court decide? They ruled 7-2 that Casey Martin did have a right to a golf cart. And the basis of the decision included an analysis of what really is essential to golf. Now, this might seem to be a strange thing for Supreme Court justices to be arguing about. Justice Stevens wrote for the court, and he said he had looked at the history of the game, he had done a lot of research, and he found that it really is about putting a small ball, hitting it a long way, and getting it into a hole. That's the nature of golf. Therefore, allowing the cart won't disrupt the essential nature of the game. Justice Scalia was among the two dissenters. And his dissent is actually very interesting from the standpoint of the philosophy of justice. He said, first of all, we judges, we don't know what the purpose of golf is. That's not our job. That's not what we learn in law school. But he actually had a more powerful point. He said, it's not possible to reason about the purpose or the nature of a game because, well, here's how he put it. To say that something is essential is ordinarily to say that it is necessary to the achievement of a certain object. But since it is the very nature of a game to have no object except amusement, that is what distinguishes games from productive activity. It is quite impossible to say that any of a game's arbitrary rules is essential. This is Scalia. So Scalia is making a pretty far-reaching attack on the fundamental Aristotelian premise of the court's decision. He's saying that games like golf have no purpose. They're arbitrary. Now, I think this was a bad piece of reasoning by Justice Scalia for two reasons. First, no sports fan would ever talk that way. if we really believed that the rules of the games we love were merely arbitrary, designed to put seats put people in the seats, it would be hard to care about the outcome of the game. No, why do people care about sports? Why do people appreciate athletic excellence? Because we think that certain athletic achievements are worthy of honor and recognition. Back to Aristotle. So that's one thing that's wrong with Scalia's opinion. He can't possibly be a sports fan talking that way. But there is another reason, I think, that his reasoning is flawed. And it's this. He really misses what's at stake in the whole debate about Casey Martin and the professional golfers. On the surface, these seem to be a debate about fairness. Will riding in a cart give him an unfair advantage? But if fairness is the only thing at stake in this golf dispute, there would have been an easy and obvious solution. What? Say it.
Everybody gets a cart.
Yes, exactly. Let everybody ride in a cart who wants to. No one has to. But everyone can. What's your name?
Louise.
Louise. So Louise offers, if fairness is all that's at stake, let everyone ride in a cart and the fairness objection goes away. But what's interesting, if you look at this dispute and listen to the golfers, the famous golfers, that solution, we can call it the fairness solution, would have been more anathema to them even than making an exception for Casey Martin. Why? It's changing the nature of the game. And why do they care so much about that? Back to honor and recognition. Why do they care? What's at stake in this dispute for them?
Their image of themselves.
Their image of themselves as champions, athletic champions.
As manly men.
As manly men? Well, something like that. Here's my hunch. I wouldn't put it maybe, what's your name? I wouldn't put it quite exactly as Sharon put it, but let me put it as delicately as possible. Golfers are a little sensitive about the athletic status of their sport. After all, there is no running or jumping involved, and the ball stands still. It's clear that golf is a game of skill. It's less clear, and some tennis players make this observation rather rudely about golfers, less clear whether it's not only a game of skill, but also an athletic activity. And in our society, honor and recognition and prestige flow more to games, to the champions, to the winners of athletic events, than to people who win games of skill. What would be a game of skill where the ball stands still? Well, billiards. Billiards is a game of skill, the ball stands still, but no one would confuse a champion billiard player with an athlete. And so perhaps the reason that Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and these great greats felt so much was at stake is that they glimpsed the Aristotelian moral of the story of this case, which is that arguments about justice and rights are about this figuring out the essential nature, in this case, of the game, and the essential nature of the game, how that's resolved, bears on the honor and recognition that the winners of that game enjoy. So here, this golfing saga that went to the Supreme Court is a wonderful illustration of Aristotle's way of thinking about justice. Now, let's move from that to a contemporary issue that I think illustrates with similar force this observation of Aristotle, the debate over same-sex marriage. Now, what is that? Let's take a poll here to get the sense of the opinion in the room. How many people think that the state should recognize same-sex marriages? Raise your hand. You're relieved to see that. Well, how many people don't think so? All right, a handful of people. Now, I want to begin with those in the minority. Now remember here, we're reasoning together. But I want to get at the reasons lying behind the two positions, then we'll see where that leads us. Who's willing, are you willing to explain, who's be willing to offer the reasons that he or she disagrees with the idea of state recognizing same-sex marriage? We need a brave soul. Go ahead.
Because the state can recognize the contract. Marriage is essentially a religious question. Let the churches decide what marriage is. Let the state decide the contractual issues. And using the word marriage by the state creates such a conflict in the society that it's pointless.
All right. Wait, keep the microphone for a minute. What's your name?
Joe.
Now, if, Joe, you don't want the state to award the title of marriage. That should be up to religious institutions. They should decide. States can recognize contracts. Would that principle lead you to say that the state should not recognize marriage between couples of the opposite sex, between men and women either?
I think having the word marriage involved in the state privilege is what's causing so much political problems. And if you remove the word marriage from the state action, you remove a lot of the conflict.
So you would get the state out of the business of recognizing any kind of marriage, would you?
Correct.
Including between a man and a woman.
Or between a man and two women, or three, or
right.
Whatever.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what Joe points out is there are actually three possible policies that a state could have with respect to marriage. It could recognize only marriage between a man and a woman. It could recognize same-sex marriage between two partners. Or, third option, the state could get out of the marriage recognition business altogether.
But not out of the contract business, not out of all the privileges that we now associate with state marriage.
Okay, so the privileges would include the economic arrangements, the inheritance arrangements, hospital visitation, that sort of thing.
Joint filing.
Right. The tax. You really care about the tax status.
Well, I think that's the issue. That's one of the remaining issues when states have granted partnership rights, and without the without access to the IRS code, there's a lot missing.
But if you provided the same economic rights and contract recognition of the sheer contract, the act of consent, essentially what you would be doing would be to universalize the practice of civil unions. Civil unions in some states are made available to same-sex couples instead of marriage. What you're really suggesting, Joe, is to allow any number of people to engage in civil unions, but that's all the state does. It doesn't recognize marriage.
They can go to the synagogue, the church, or
right.
The universal life church, whatever.
Let's call that the third position, which is the abolition of marriage as a state function, leaving it to private associations, to churches, synagogues, mosques. In fact, the opinion writer, Michael Kinsley, offered early on in the same-sex marriage debate a version of Joe's proposal where he said, let anyone who wants to get married, regardless of the sex of the partner or the number of partners, get married by a church, by a synagogue, by a mosque. Let casinos and department stores confer marriage recognition if people want to go to them. But let the state get out of it. Now, that's the third position. I want to hear from someone who defends the first traditional marriage and who thinks the state should only recognize marriage between one man and one woman and not between partners of the same sex. Who's prepared to defend that position? Yes, go ahead.
First of all, you have a natural law, and then you have human law. Natural law is based on nature. Human law is based on humans. The foundation, if you go to the core of human law, for humans, a lot of it is based in nature.
All right, we're trying to decide what the human law should be, and tell us how nature or natural law should inform that choice.
I'm going to get to that point.
Yeah.
You have the human female body and the human male body, and that dictates procreation.
Procreation.
Correct. So if you have a male and a male, or a female and a female, procreation cannot go forward.
Okay.
Without technical
right,
or technology existence.
Right. Okay. And and what's your name?
Eric.
Eric? So Eric says that what's distinctive about marriage between a man and a woman is that it's about procreation. Now, that the argument that the purpose of marriage is procreation is, actually, you saw the young man in the student, you remember, in the video excerpt, made a point similar to Eric's, that the purpose of marriage is procreation. And now, who would like to respond to that argument, the argument that Eric, right, what would you say?
If that argument were true, then it would be highly unlikely to find any animals in the natural world that exhibit behavior that we associate as gay behavior in humans. And there was recently like some penguins at a zoo that received a lot of news press because these two male penguins were exhibiting like mating behavior, and they were trying to take an egg from another couple of penguins because they couldn't have eggs on their own. And they wanted to use their egg.
They were trying to use artificial means of reproduction? Is that what you're saying? The penguins were?
Well, it wasn't artificial, but...
They were trying to steal an egg?
Yes.
I hadn't read about that. So, and what's your name?
I'm Amy.
Amy is saying that if we're going to appeal to nature, we have to see what happens in the natural world. We have to see how penguins do it. And... maybe the testimony of penguins and of nature may be ambiguous about whether the purpose of marriage is procreation. On the other hand, the state doesn't recognize marriage among penguins, same sex or opposite sex. So the way I read, let me see, Eric, you'll tell me if I'm misconstruing or simply in developing your point a little bit. As I heard Eric, what he was saying was, yes, nature is a source of insight about what the point of marriage is, namely procreation, but that procreation is the point of union between a man and a woman, and marriage should, the state recognition of marriage should honor and recognize that procreative role. Is that a fair elaboration, Eric? Okay, so now let's hear from someone who would like to respond to that argument. Yes, go ahead.
But the state does not require procreation as a requirement for marriage, and that there are senior citizens who are allowed to get married, women who have had hysterectomies are allowed to get married, men who cannot have an erection are allowed to get married. It's, you know, historically, procreation was something that was only really mattered in the more aristocratic classes.
All right, let me stop. It's really interesting. Keep the microphone for a second. Your name again is Sharon. So Sharon. I'm sorry?
Excuse me.
Cheryl or Sharon?
Sharon.
So procreation, so Sharon is pointing to many opposite sex unions where procreation is not part of the purpose and where procreation may not even be possible, and yet the state does recognize marriage among those couples.
Allows it.
Well, allows the marriage, but confers a marriage license.
Right.
And so that reasoning by analogy suggests, tell me if I've got it right, that procreation can't be the sole or the primary purpose of marriage as currently practiced in our society?
Yes.
All right, now if that's the case, so there would be a point of disagreement between Eric and Sharon. Now what would you say? If not procreation, what is the purpose of marriage, what qualities does it or should it honor and recognize, if not procreation?
I actually happen to belong to the state should get out of the marriage
so
business.
You're with Joe.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, that's good. Now I want to hear, just to complete this argument, is there someone who disagrees that marriage is mainly about procreation, who favors same-sex marriage, the second position, and believes it should be honored and recognized. And if so, why? Who else? Yes, go in the back.
So if not for just procreation, another reason would be that it's marriage is the... I mean, I'm not married, so in my opinion, marriage should be about the love that the two people or more share between each other, not specifically whether or not they can procreate or whether or not the Catholic Church agrees with it or any other sort of religious institution.
But the affirmative purpose that marriage is about, that we honor and recognize, you say, is a loving relationship between...
Two people. Or three, it doesn't matter.
Or three, okay.
I am fine with most kinds of marriages personally. I think that if somebody wants to have a man and a woman, that doesn't change, that doesn't make their marriage any less important or any more important just because of the rights of another group of people.
Okay, and what's your name?
Sarah.
Sarah. All right, I want to step back from the positions that have been... go ahead. Give us one more. Yeah, go ahead.
I think there's some benefit to society in the stable family-building function of marriage, that when there's a homestead that a group of people belong to, their ability to participate civically increases the ability to volunteer at a shelter, to become part of their communities. If there are children involved, if there's an adult who can stay with the children, I think that there's a benefit to society generally when people bunk up in a stable way that predicts a future.
And so that would argue for which of these three policies?
For opening the definition of marriage or any term that received widespread respect to any adults able to form stable partnerships.
And with the stable partnerships, what else, what would have to be their character? Would they have to be, in order to qualify for this public recognition, do you think, that loving relationships, exclusive, long-term, what would be the ingredients?
I've felt grateful not to have to ask myself the question about non-monogamy odd and even numbers. I've basically been grateful to look at... it's a good question. I can't answer personally half of it.
And what's your name?
I'm Jenny. Jenny.
Jenny. Okay. Thank you. All right. Listen to the argument. It's been an amazingly civil argument. Maybe that's because we're in the LA Public Library, haven't we? But there is something that's very striking about even the brief discussion we've just had. We've identified three possible positions the state could take with respect to marriage. And which of those policies people favor draws us quickly into a discussion of two closely connected questions. What is the point or the purpose or the essential nature of marriage? Is it about procreation? Or is it about a lifelong loving commitment that creates a stable family structure? There are disagreements about the purpose of marriage that lead to different conclusions about how the rights should be allocated, and closely connected to those competing conceptions of the purpose or the essential nature of marriage are different ideas about what qualities in a union are worthy of honor and recognition and support by the political community as a whole. In that respect, the debate over same-sex marriage is structurally very similar to the debate over the golf cart, which in turn is similar to the debate over the flute. All in each of these three cases, the arguments we have about defining rights and the meaning of justice, those arguments have to do, whether we are explicit about it or not, with one's view about the purpose of a social practice, whether it's musical performance or a sport or marriage, and what's worthy of honor and recognition by the community. Now, why is this a powerful discovery, if it is a discovery, that an insight that Aristotle's philosophy sheds on these contemporary debates? We often these days tend to think that when we're arguing in public about rights, whether it's affirmative action or same-sex marriage or income distribution or inequality or bailouts, we don't want to be judgmental. We want to avoid having to delve into the deep and fiercely contested moral convictions and beliefs that people bring to public life. So we try to say, well, let's try to be neutral. Let's try not to resolve those competing moral ideas about what marriage is for or about what unions are really worthy of honor and recognition. Let's just try to set those moral disagreements, and sometimes they are religiously informed disagreements, let's set them aside. But if Aristotle's right, as these examples illustrate, justice is unavoidably judgmental. We are drawn in to argument, reflection, debate about the fundamental purposes of social institutions, whether colleges and universities or marriage, whatever the case may be. And in doing that, we have to argue about what social and moral practices are worthy of honor and recognition and what ones aren't. And so you might think, isn't this a recipe for a kind of culture war? Part of the argument that I'm offering in the book is that what we really need for a richer public discourse is to acknowledge and to engage with the deeply held moral convictions that people bring to public life, not try to avoid them. There are two different ways of contending with the fact that we live in a pluralist society where people disagree about moral questions. One is a strategy of avoidance. Let's try not to get involved in that. Let's try to decide these questions as if we could without engaging with these moral questions. Call that the strategy of avoidance. I'm in the book trying to call that into question and to suggest that what we need to elevate our public discourse is a more robust engagement with the moral disagreements and the moral convictions that citizens bring to public life. Not because we're all going to agree, but because a democratic deliberation that engages openly and deliberately with the moral convictions that people care about will make for a richer public life. And it's even a truer form, I think, of civic respect. Not to try to ignore moral convictions with which I disagree in public, but to engage with them, to listen to them, to disagree with them, to offer reasons, as we've just been doing here, rather than to flee them. So that's my suggestion. And what the book really is about is that it's a small effort to try to contribute to a better, richer, more morally engaged public deliberation by democratic citizens than the shouting matches to which we have these days become accustomed. So that's the goal. What I'd like to do, since we have a few minutes left, is really to open the floor for questions, whether on the issues we've just been discussing, on the broader themes of justice, in relation to the book, in relation to the course. Yes. And we have microphones so that everyone can hear you.
Wouldn't you say that the discussion is actually not about moral convictions, but all the cases that you presented, the golf game and the marriage, are about definitions we actually trying to define what is a golf game, what is the essence of it, what is the essence of marriage. Is it for reproduction or for love and bonding?
Right.
So if we would have agreed on the definition of what it is,
right,
maybe there wouldn't be different moral convictions.
Right. Okay, fair enough. If there were a way of defining the purpose of marriage, let's say, what is marriage, just objectively, then we could avoid these questions. I agree. But I think the definitions at stake here are unavoidably normative. They're not scientific. They're not linguistic. They're not the kind of definitions we could simply look up in Webster's dictionary and resolve the question. That's why they are so contested. So they are the kind, when we're involved in trying to define the real purpose or point or meaning of marriage or of an athletic event or of a college or a university, those disputes about definitions are not merely linguistic. They are moral and political. And that's true, it seems to me, of all the disputes about definitions of social institutions that we have that find their way into political argument. If it were simply a linguistic matter that we could look up in the dictionary and resolve, it wouldn't be a political debate. It could be resolved by linguists. But instead, these are questions about the definition of the purpose of social practices that require not linguists, but philosophically engaged democratic citizens. That's how it seems to me. Anyhow, it's a very good question. Who else? Yes. There's a microphone coming your way.
Your point about democratic citizenry engaging in conversation about morals and justice.
Yes.
Isn't that, I worry that that's only done with a limited number of citizens.
Here in the L.A. Public Library.
No, not in the L.A. Public Library.
Right.
In the health debates, in that travesty that occurred last weekend in Washington where the Fox broadcasters were simply encouraging people. There's so much that's going on that is just divisive, strident.
Yes.
How can you hope that your view of what civic and moral and justice is how many people would actually contribute to that?
So you are skeptical that my book will carry much weight at Fox News. You may be right about that.
I am very skeptical.
You may be right about that, but I want to try to persuade even the folks at Fox News in the following way, and here's how. Take the healthcare debate. Now, it's true, there are a lot of false charges. There is a lot of strident rhetoric. Yes, I agree. Who could deny it? But there is also, in the debate about whether there should be a national healthcare system with something like universal coverage, there are competing conceptions of justice on both sides. Now, I'm in favor of universal healthcare, but I think it's important in defending that position to be able to recognize and articulate fairly the idea of justice lying behind the other view. I'm not saying on Fox News they always articulate it very well, but here's what that idea is. There are some people who believe, here's the best case against, the best argument of justice against universal health care. There are people who say that justice means respecting individual freedom and individual choice. And they interpret individual freedom as abiding by the choices people make through markets and market relations. And if you accept that view of individual freedom, that market-based view of freedom, then for the state to come and tax those who have earned their money fairly and squarely to help other people they don't know pay for health care is a violation of individual liberty and is unjust. That is the libertarian theory of justice that is friendly to basically unfettered markets. So there is a certain idea of freedom and of individual choice and consent that underlies that position about healthcare at its best. And so the way ideally we should argue about it is to make explicit that view of freedom and individual choice, that market freedom idea, and challenge it with another more robust idea of freedom or of the common good that says there that suggests there are certain obligations that we have as fellow citizens for one another to provide for a decent way of life, including the provision of health, such that health should not be subject to one's ability to pay. And let's have that debate. Now, that would look very different from the debate we've been having or in the town hall meetings. But there are rival theories of justice at stake, and to decide what should be done about health care, we have to work our way through those rival conceptions. Do we have time for one more?
A quick one.
All right, a quick one. Yes, go ahead.
One concern I have about your suggestion is at least when you get into the legal issues and courts, their legitimacy is in part derived from the perception that they're objective, they're not making policy decisions.
Right, that's good.
And you are suggesting that you open up those policy decisions and say this Constitution is what we say it is because we believe that, not because of anything that was written in the Constitution,
right,
because it's good policy today.
Well, okay.
And I think that undermines their legitimacy and
of the courts.
Whereas people might, and other kind of supposedly objective bodies as opposed to political bodies,
right,
where those
good
discussions are supposed to take
place. Okay, that's good. It's a great question. So, and one way, I hope I'm being fair to the question, to reformulate it this way, these arguments about justice that reach to the underlying moral ideas, should they take place among citizens in the democratic political process, or should they take place among judges who have, after all, a law and a constitution to interpret? And what I would say to that is, arguments about justice and even of morality are unavoidable in both places. We saw, even in what seemed like a fairly silly case of a golf cart, the issue that rose to the Supreme Court, they were unable to define the rights under the law without engaging in the kind of inquiry that reached to the essential nature of golf. So sometimes courts, despite their protestations to objectivity and neutrality, are drawn into these arguments, and I think they should be more explicit and honest about it than just try to pretend, no, we're just objectively, mechanically applying a statute that has a fixed meaning or definition. But what I'm also suggesting is that justice is not only a matter for courts. Justice is too important to leave the judges. Justice should also be the province of democratic citizens. Which means, and I guess with this, Betsy is telling me I should close, to be a democratic citizen is, in part, to be a philosopher, which is to suggest that we need to engage with these questions even to exercise our civic responsibilities. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for a wonderful evening.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.